Well, yesterday we completed this chapter, Rebirth. And if you remember, we had ended with this idea that this is the true dynamic belief in rebirth, and there too the play of the questioning intellect ceases. Certainly there remains the question of the mechanism of the development and of the laws of rebirth, where the intellect and its inquiries and generalizations can still have some play. Now, I had indicated that we will take up this question of the mechanism, and I find that very well explained in the subsequent chapters called Rebirth and Karma. Of course, there is a whole section on karma, and I think we don't have time for going through the theory of karma, and as it is, we are not concentrating on the theory of karma. But rebirth and karma are again inseparable, and this chapter also brings to the front another inseparable idea that goes with the concept of rebirth. Yesterday's class we said the most important idea connected with rebirth is the question of the soul's evolution. If we do not understand or accept this concept of the evolution of the soul, then the theory of rebirth has no place. And now we come to another section that is there only this individual rebirth? Because if there is a rebirth of the individual, then is it purely a question of the soul deciding what experience it wants, and then what kind of a growth it wants, and what does it want to express in this life? Then what happens to this kshetra, the earth, where the soul comes to take its birth? Does it have any role? Does it have any influence? Does it have any say in the soul's decision? Now it is in answer to this role of the kshetra that we come to the theory of karma. Because after all, the soul is manifesting in a preordained manifestation called earth. And so if the soul is taking birth on this earth, the earth itself should have some kind of a say. And that is what we can call karma. And again, it is not just individual karma. There are different levels of karma. The individual karma, the community or group karma, there's a nation karma, and there's a karma of humanity. So if we take this dimension into consideration, then we see this whole theory of rebirth has to be redefined. Up until now, what all we saw about rebirth, how it depends on my karma and what am I doing here and the way I act upon this life, it was said, as we said, that was also a very preliminary account of human birth, connecting it to my individual karma. But then Sri Aurobindo would say, we are not just individuals, there are so many other levels of karma. So what is the full picture that emerges? That we are intricately interwoven with the whole universe. We are not just ourselves. There is no individual cut-off per se. He is inalienably linked with the earth consciousness. He is linked with the evolution of the earth. He is linked with the evolution of the group. So in this chapter, we have a beautiful new dimension of the group, the nation, the humanity that surrounds the individual. And it is here that we get a beautiful explanation of karma. But if you want to know the theory of karma, then you go to the fundamental chapter here called Karma. That is on page 125 of this volume 16. That is a basic definition of karma, but I am skipping that for lack of time. But in this chapter, we get sufficiently enough clarification regarding karma for us to be able to link it with rebirth. And as our intention here is only to link with rebirth, I selected this chapter called Rebirth and Karma. That is on page 153. The ancient idea of karma was inseparably connected with the belief in the soul's continual rebirth in new bodies. And this close association was not a mere accident, but a perfectly intelligible and indeed inevitable union of two related truths which are needed for each other's completeness and can with difficulty exist in separation. These two things are the soul's side and nature's side of one and the same cosmic sequence. Rebirth is meaningless without karma, and karma has no fount of inevitable origin and no rational and no moral justification if it is not an instrumentality for the sequences of the soul's continuous experience. So you see, we have got it linked with what we said yesterday, that rebirth is there for the soul's evolution. But you see, this sequences of the soul's continuous experience, which happens through rebirth, has got to have this outer expression, as it calls it here, the nature side, that is karma. So this is how you would call that these are really an inevitable union. So we have two things, rebirth and karma, with an underline of soul's evolution. So these three concepts must go actually together. And then he would say, if we believe that the soul is repeatedly reborn in the body, we must believe also that there is some link between the life that preceded and the life that followed, and the past of the soul has an effect on its future, and that is the spiritual essence of the law of karma. To deny it would be to establish a reign of the most chaotic incoherence, such as we find only in the leaps and turns of the mind in dream, or in the thoughts of madness, and hardly even there. So you can see the emphasis given by Sri Aurobindo on this theory of karma, that if this karma and rebirth are not connected, then you hardly can explain our life, our actions, our thoughts. It's completely just a chaotic incoherence. So it's no wonder that how our ancients found the truth of rebirth and karma And that is what gave a kind of a meaning and a stability to our entire individual and social system also. You see, it's been wonderfully woven. You will see next when it talks about the group dharma or the group karma. You see, all these notions of karma and dharma and rebirth, you see, these are some of the foundations of the Indian social culture. Today we may not recognize, we may not understand, but if you dig deep into its, the secret of this perennial Indian society, some of these are the fundamental lines along with our society grew, and because of which we are even surviving today after thousands of years. So it is these that we should recognize and not just go about saying, you know, okay, we are there for the expression of art and music. But if a society is not stable, even all that art and music and sculpture would have vanished long back. But this is what bound the individual to the collective. So we have now rebirth, karma and dharma. These three principles are the tripod of our Indian society. Now coming back, so it says, if you do not connect these two, then the whole thing becomes a chaotic incoherence. And if this existence were, as the cosmic pessimist imagines, a dream or an illusion, or worse, as Schopenhauer would have it, a delirium and insanity of the soul, we might accept some such law of inconsequent consequence. But taken even at its worst, this world of life differs from dream, illusion and madness by its plan of fine, complex and subtle sequences, the hanging together and utility even of its discords, the general and particular harmony of its relations, which if they are not the harmony we would have, not our longed for ideal harmony, has still at every point the stamp of a wisdom and an idea at work. It is not the act of a mind in tatters or a machine in dislocation. Well, of course, it's a longish line, but the essence you would have understood. You know, it's only re-emphasizing the interrelatedness between this rebirth and karma. And it is not, our life is not as some would have imagined it to be, a dream or a delirium or an insanity or a disillusion. He says all those things are philosophies well said, but our life really stands on something else. It is based on a deeper wisdom and a greater idea, which is really this question of rebirth, fundamental source evolution and karma. This, the continuous existence of the soul in rebirth must signify an evolution, if not of the self, for that is said to be immutable, yet of its more outward active soul or self of experience. This evolution is not possible if there is not a connected sequence from life to life, a result of action and experience, an evolutionary sequence of the soul, a law of karma. Now we see how intricately the question of karma comes in. You see, till now what we have seen is the exclusive emphasis on the soul's choice. That the soul says, in my next life I want to have this experience, to be this or to do that. But then, is it a kind of a completely isolated and haphazard and independent decision? No, this is where now we are coming to terms with karma. It is not that independent decision. That means there is an interlinking between the present birth and the next birth. And that link is called karma. You see, he's slowly leading us step by step. So, birth to birth, what goes is the psychic being or the soul. But the mechanism or the process or the bridge or the link, call what you want, is called karma. And now he takes up the theory of karma. And on the side of karma, if we give to that its integral and not a truncated meaning, we must admit rebirth for the sufficient field of its action. For karma is not quite the same thing as a material or substantial law of cause and effect, the antecedent and its mechanical consequence. This is the common definition of karma, what we think of law of cause and effect. So basically we think it to be a law of cause and effect, and more so on the level of your physical actions. Of course, on the level of physics, there is this law, what we call the Newton's law. So Newton's law is basically this law of cause and effect. You have a certain energy pushed in, you have the effect of that much energy that really gets effectuated. But that is what we think, that either is a law of cause and effect or an antecedent and a consequence. So this is what we have understood. But he says, that would perfectly admit of a karma which would be carried on in time, and the results come with certainty in their proper place, their just degree by a working out of the balance of forces, but need not in any way touch the human originator, who might have passed away from the scene by the time the result of his acts got into manifestation. If you remember, we were given this same argument before, that you see, if I, for example, push this bottle, I have put in certain energy, and I see the result of this energy, when I push it, it goes by 3 inches forward. So that means, this effect depends on the cause, that is my pushing, and it depends on how much energy I have put into this push. If I put greater energy, then the effect will be much more. But what is the argument here? That I am able to be the cause and also see the effect. But in karma, it doesn't happen. You see, many times, in fact most of the times, what I do today, it results in something, the results of my action of today are seen perhaps in my next birth. When my soul comes with a new body. So what Sri Aurobindo is saying, that most of the time, but need not in any way touch the human originator who might have passed away from the scene. From the scene means not only of this birth to the next birth, but I remember Mother explaining us that even sometimes when you have prayers, you have prayed for something, the result doesn't come in your expected time. You even forget about it. But then later, sometime in life, it comes back or it comes then. Suddenly you feel, hey, I never even thought of that. But she says, no, you had prayed long time back. And its effect is coming at a time perhaps when you have changed, when you don't remember. At that time you may feel it as a grace. But then the mother would say, you had yourself prayed for that. So you see, and sometimes it can also happen, you know, I think there was recently a case, when for a crime you did 10 years back, you are punished now, and maybe within these 10 years you have completely changed your consciousness, your life pattern, your beliefs, your whole modus operandi, your whole style of living, your own level of living, but that can catch up with you even after 10 years or 15 years. So what Sri Aurobindo is telling is, this is what happens if it is a purely a mechanical nature of effect, of cause and effect. When will the effect come? We don't know when. It could be next birth, next year, 20 years later, anytime. So he says, a mechanical nature could well visit the sins of the fathers not on them, but on the fourth or the 400th generation, as indeed this physical nature does, and no objection of injustice or any other mental or moral objection could rise. For the only justice or reason of a mechanism is that it shall work according to the law of its structure and the fixed eventuality of its force in action. So you see here, he's telling us the possibility that it could be on the fourth or the 400th generation. And he's writing all this because he will lead us to this idea of the group karma. That means what a collectivity does. I mean, its results can come back to the collectivity or for the group even after 10 years or 15 years or fourth generation, or of course he gives us an extreme case of a 400th generation. But this long 400th generation, etc., does actually apply in the case of a nation. You know, that is why we have to see who are the leaders of a nation. Because what they do today, it may really come up after 100 years or 200 years or 400 years. So there is a long-term karma also. So here we say, we cannot demand from it a mind or a moral equity or any kind of supraphysical responsibility. The universal energy grinds out inconsciously its effects, and individuals are only fortuitous and subordinate means of its workings. The soul itself, if there is a soul, makes only a part of the mechanism of nature, exists not for itself, but as a utility for her business. Well, as I told you right in the beginning, in this chapter, he takes more the view of a universal collectivity. What happens on the group karma, on a collectivity, on a nation karma, etc. But he's taking the largest view of nature herself, what he calls here the structure, the mechanism of nature, the universal energy. So in brief, if I have to repeat this idea, that there is a universal mechanism where there is no injustice, but there is a time span. And so whatever energies we put into today on the individual level, collective level, nation level, is bound to reap its harvest, but depending on what time. And that time could be anything, maybe not even relevant to the individual. And in this cosmic injustice and in this cosmic movement, these individuals are only tools. So you see, it changes considerably our idea of rebirth. It's not, as we said previously, just what I do and, you know, my karma is there, my individual birth is there, next life I say, I want to be a poet, next life. It's not that. Because after all these individuals make the contents of the universal energy. So he even uses the word that these souls are a utility for her business. So there is a universal spirit, a universal energy, which is utilizing our individual rebirths for her own set purpose. We'll come to this explanation little more, with a greater clarity in the next para. I will see if we can go till there. Now, but karma is more than a mechanical law of antecedent and consequence. So this is the second part now. First part we said is a universal energy which is a mechanical law of antecedent and consequence, which is there on the universal level. You cannot calculate it. You cannot even sort of guess what it would be. But the second level, it says, is something much more. Karma is action. There is a thing done and a doer, and an active consequence. So there are three elements: an action done, a doer, and a consequence. Now you can see this division. These three are the three joints, the three locks, the three sandhis of the connexes of karma. So this analysis tells us so well that karma is not just action. There is action, the doer, and the effect, or the consequence, or the karma phala, as we say. So now if we know these three things, it is easier to act. So where do we belong? We are the doers. But the consequence we cannot have control on. Because it may be part of the universal energy that it will not bring the consequence of your action to you now. Therefore the Gita says you have no right, you have no control on the fruit of your labor, the fruit of your work. That is in the hands of the universal energy, or what we call in the divine's hand, in God's hands, whatever way you want to call it. So out of these three, the other one, there's a thing done. Then an action is there to be done. Now this, is it in our control or not? Now can we be the doers of a certain action? And first of all I would say, can we separate the doer and the done? We cannot split them. The only thing we can separate is, the doer done is one, the consequence is another. That is separable, because that separates itself with a time gap. Whereas the doer and the done are now. Because if I lift this bottle, the doer and the done are together. I cannot say, I will lift the bottle. That is also a doer and done, because I am thinking already about it. So let us be very clear, the doer and the done is one inseparable part, and the consequence is another. So this is why we have to do what we say, kartavyam karma. What we have to do because we are the doers. But the other thing, the consequence, we don't know. So this has been philosophized into nishkama karma. You have to do that, what is to be done. But the sick consequence we don't know. So he says, this is the three locks or the three sandhis of the connexes of karma. And it's a complex mental, moral, physical working. For the law of it is not less true of the mental and moral than the physical consequence of the act to the doer. The will and the idea are the driving force of the action, and the momentum does not come from some commotion in my chemical atoms, or some working of iron and electron, or some weird biological effervescence. So this is an interesting sentence. I paused at it when I read it. If you read this again, it says, the will and the idea are the driving force of the action, and not what the modern biologists are trying to analyze, that even life is a kind of a chemistry. You have an excess of this kind of a glandular, you know, activity, and it turns into anger. You have an excess of this kind of a glandular activity, it turns into love. You have an excess of this kind of an activity, it turns into passion. So they are trying to bring down emotion to the level of the physical glandular activity. But here is telling us very clearly that it's not some commotion in my chemical atoms or some working of iron and electron. They are, in fact, all this iron and electron and some chemical atoms, they get activated by this will and idea. I think that's something that we need to understand and think about. Because I have known some scientists, in fact I met a couple of them in Delhi in my recent visit, who are trying to see everything in the physical cell. That how much are our emotions, our aspirations, even our spiritual aspirations are all embedded in the self. So our loves and our passions and our desires and our goodwill and our compassion, even our lust, all the things they think are embedded in this, in the, they call neurons and whatever they call. But here we get something in Sri Aurobindo that obviously is the idea that precedes and not the action or the chemical of the body that precedes. Therefore, the act and consequence must have some relation to the will and the idea, and there must be a mental and moral consequence to the soul which has the will and idea. So if you understand it in this manner, what happens? That means the origin of my action is in my will and idea. And if it is there in my will and idea, then if I can control my mind, then my actions can be controlled. Whereas the other biologist, if he says, no, my passion is in my cells and because of my chemistry, they say, you know, if I got into a situation, my adrenaline increases and therefore I become active or anxious and all that. But if you put it on your physical, you have no control on the cells. But I can have control on my will and idea, because they are the real source of my action. Because you see, sometimes a very mundane thing, for example, if I'm thinking of certain food, I mean, it has happened in my own house, Deepshika is down cooking and I'm upstairs in my study room, and sometimes an idea comes, so I would like to have that for breakfast, and I go down and say, Deep, you're cooking that. She says, no, nothing of the sort, it's completely different. So to the extent that if you have an idea, then the whole, your tongue also starts tasting and you start getting the smell of the thing. So the first thing is the idea that really clicks your senses, clicks on. So here he's saying that it is the relation of the idea and the will that is important. And the second point is, and there must be a mental and moral consequence to the soul. So now if we step back and see that this will and idea are the most important thing, then this question of morality, question of spirituality, all these things are based on the level of idea and will. So why we are Sri Aurobindo is, there's a small para there, emphasizing on this will and idea, is that we normally think karma to be an action. But on the contrary, karma begins with your will and idea, and it results in an action. So we should not judge saying, oh, I've done something wrong. But you have to say, I have thought something wrong first. I willed something wrong first. I have the idea of something wrong first. Next step, you regress one more step. Where does it lead to? That your consciousness was something low, by which you thought wrongly, you wished something wrong. You had an idea which is in the dark level. So that is, if you go down, it is a consciousness. And in the same circumstances, if your consciousness were at that time in an inward mood and the heights of consciousness, spirituality, then the same action you will not have, the same ideas you will not respond. So now what we understand when Sri Aurobindo tells us, change your consciousness and that will change your outer action. Not by a moralistic, religious, ceremonial, ritualistic thing that will change your consciousness. And had we not read it before also, he says nothing of the outer changes the inner. And that is one of the arguments to say nothing of the rituals, the ceremonies and all that of religiosity can change ever your consciousness. Because the outer doesn't change the inner. Because the origin is the inner. So change the inner and that will reflect on the outer. So what is driving at is towards that change of consciousness. That, if we admit the individual as a real being, signifies the continuity of act and consequence to him, and therefore rebirth for a field of this working. It is evident that in one life we do not and cannot labor out and exhaust all the values and powers of that life, but only carry on a past thread, weave out something in the present, prepare infinitely more for the future. It is evident that in one life we do not and cannot labor out and exhaust all the values and powers of that life. Obviously, in one life we have so many ideas, so much wanting to do, we cannot labor out. There's no space, there's no time. Because whatever we will, if we have to effectuate that, there's always the play of time. Is it only time? No. There is the other. There is the outer. There is the group. There is the collectivity. So this is what we come to in the next para, that we have to consider the other. So this chapter I found so very beautiful because of this dimension that he adds. And Sri Aurobindo, as we know, is always this dual dimension, the individual and the collective, the individual and the group. So he will never take you in an isolated manner, because on reading this, I understood that had we just left with the previous chapter of rebirth, the whole focus would have been on my individualistic life. That I have to live this way, I have to go this way, then irrespective of the collectivity. I may even denounce the collectivity and get into a shell and say, no, I must have a spiritual life, I must have a concentrated life. But here it tells us, sorry, you are not alone. There's a whole world behind you. This consequence of rebirth would not follow from the very nature of karma if there were only an all soul of the universe. For then it would be that which is carrying on in myriads of forms is past, working out some present result, spinning yarn of karma for a future weft of consequence. So now we are going to get into this, again, the universal all soul. So what he is telling us in this para would be that actually the individual is only an expression of this all soul. And this all soul, which is what? Spinning yarn of karma for a future weft of consequence, working out some present result, and it has worked out in the forms of the past. That means it only shows us there is this universal consciousness which is constantly planning, executing, utilizing some of these individuals in its universal plan. It is the all soul which would be the originator, would upbear the force of the act, would receive and exhaust or again take up for further uses the returning force of the consequence. You see, I think this is, of course, a lot of research needs to be done. Historical research can be done on these ideas. Well, when Sri Aurobindo is telling us returning force of the consequence, I mean, that's what he means. Even in history we have seen, for example, if a poet in his own lifetime may not be very popular or may not have reached so much the public, maybe sometimes the public has rejected him. But a century or two later, then that positive energy and the new ideas, they come back. And they come back with a greater vengeance. I mean, even in history, why take our own simple example of the mother? I mean, when she was an Egyptian queen, she wanted to bring in a beautiful temple for the supreme sun god. She even attempted one big temple there. But that was a kind of a seed idea of a sun god, of a single god, of a transcendent godhead. But within a generation or two, the whole temple was desecrated. Her law, her rule was completely out. I mean, of course, whatever the remnant there were there. But you see, centuries later, again the mother comes back, brings out the same idea of the sun god, but this time it's the supramental godhead. Brings out the same idea of the temple, but this time it's the Matrimandir. So you see, sometimes the seed ideas that are being worked out, they come out generations and centuries later. So this is the consequence. So in a way, what happens? What do we learn from this? That we should put in our positive energy, even if the world, the society, the community is against you at that time. Because this is a normal argument that we have. We say, oh, the whole system is bad. How can one man change the system? But do we not have the beautiful example of Sri Aurobindo's accepting the Cripps proposal and then telling, I knew it would be rejected and still I have to do my nishkama karma. These are not his words, don't quote me like that. But this is the meaning. That the right thing ought to be done, which has to be done. Because that creates this positive energy and later it will bear its fruit in the time space. So if you want to do something right and good in spite of the community and the society, we should go ahead. We may not be able to see its fruit even in our own life. But the goodness, the positiveness, the rightness of spiritual vibration will hold its ground. And so you would say, nothing essential would depend on its doing all these things through the same individual mask of its being. For the individual would only be a prolonged moment of the all soul, and what it originated in this moment of its being, which I call myself, might very well produce its result on some other moment of the same being, which from the point of view of my ego would be somebody quite different from and unconnected with myself. So this is the universal force. It starts an action in me. In me called Mr. So-and-so. But this action which it starts in me, the universal all-soul may not see its result in this body. But for the all-soul it doesn't matter. It has started an action, it will see its result in another body. But for the all-soul it says, what is important for me is that I start an action, I take it forward, I see to its fulfillment in some time future. And that is, I suppose, the work of the avatars. They perhaps don't come in the moment needed. They come at a point and put a seed idea, a seed consciousness through an individual, the all soul, the transcendent soul manifests a consciousness, an idea. And then there is a seeding time, you know, there's got to be perfect rain, there's got to be perfect sun, there's got to be moments, there could be storm, there could be anything. But the seed sown by the avatar comes out much later. And that is really the opportune time. But somehow, with the coming of Mother and Sri Aurobindo, the seed time and the flowering time are not completely together, but still it is not a dormant seed. It is not a seed that's lain too deep into earth. It has been lain in their own lifetime. They have put the seed deep into earth and in their own lifetime it sprouted. And that is why I understand what Sri Aurobindo called the hour of God. He says, now the seed is sprouting. In our own lifetime, lifetimes imagine, is not 2000 years later or 500 years later. So he said, this is the hour of God, this is the sprouting time. Where little effort can really give you large consequences. Great results, he calls. So this is the time where little effort can end up in great results, because this is the seed time, it's the sprouting time of the seed of Shivabhava's consciousness. And now you apply this to the whole world sequence, world consequences. They're all nothing but the seed is breaking this hard crust of the earth. So this entire resistance, you know, what was under the earth is bursting out. And all the darkness, all the muck, all the victimization, all the violence, all the dirt is coming through. So, because I was deeply concerned with this, has the hour of God stopped ticking with the passing away of the mothers? And long after I went to Nalini and asked him, Nalinida, he said, no, the hour is still ticking. Is there. So this is the hour when we have to make a little effort. And a little effort towards that central aspiration. Because later on we can achieve all the external crowns on our head. But for the inner realization, this sprouting time is the most important. Later on, we have to put in maybe 100 times the greater effort, even for the spiritual aspiration and to say, Ma, I love you. That's why today youngsters, even though they have not seen the mother, can have this aspiration, because this is the sprouting time. But 50 years later, 100 years later, maybe the hour of God may become a little more silent, because obviously their physical presence, the aura of their light is magnificently around. So when Nalinida told me about that, I was greatly relieved, because there was a kind of a little fright and anxiety in me that has it ended.